In ancient Roman Greece, a specific mnemonic device was developed called the Method of Loki. The basic idea of this memory enhancement strategy is to associate items you want to remember with specific physical locations. I first heard about this technique when I was very young. Being a 7-year-old who was constantly scolded by adults for not remembering anything I was told, I hoped that those ancient Greeks could save me some trouble. And so, I spent a good amount of time staring at grey Soviet buildings in my neighborhood and trying to associate a balcony or a window frame with one thing or another my mom had told me I was supposed to do. Needless to say, this didn't work very well. But later, I often came back to this episode of my childhood, for I noticed that places, objects, and smells sometimes evoke memories you didn't even know existed. It's hard to trust one's memory, and in recent years, the unreliability of it has been researched through and through. But in cases of significant trauma, an even bigger question arises. How much do we actually want to remember? Is remembering the beginning of healing or hell? And what literature can do in the process? This is Literature from Finland podcast. I'm Urte from Helsinki Literary Agency. And in this episode, the winner of the Best Literary Debut of the Year, Susanna Hast, discusses auto-theoretical narration and literature of remembering. Welcome, Susanna.
Thank you so much.
I used a rather pompous phrase in the introduction, literature of remembering. And so I would like to begin with a question. Is all literature, in fact, literature of remembering?
I love that idea of literature of remembering. I've actually started to write remember with a hyphen between re and member because it reminds me of the membrane. Which is a barrier that keeps something out and lets something in. So, that makes it more material because memory is something abstract and we don't know where it's located and where it goes, where memories go when we don't remember them. And yeah, I think that all literature is about memory and remembering. And to remember is to keep something alive, so literature keeps memory alive. But there's also literature of forgetfulness and forgetting, and literature of failed remembering, and literature of incomplete forgetting. And this is perhaps the category where my book goes to.
I was just about to say, your book is a little bit of all those categories. Your debut work, The Body of Evidence, is sort of a case study of sexual abuse. The narrator of the book tries to reconstruct what happened to her when she was a child. But the memories are vague, as the human mind has a tendency to block the most horrible things out of our consciousness. In the text, you describe the constant feeling of remembering either too little or too much, and all of it happens sort of at the same time. So what eventually leads to remembering?
And yes, the book is a case study of sexual abuse, sexual violence, but it's also a trial. And it's also about the uncanny. It's about aroundness and about absence. And my upbringing was the sort where absence of memory was preferred. So memory is something or the past is something that is brutal, and to survive it you have to forget about it and never speak of it. But it didn't work out for me. I was haunted. And one day, and I don't remember why or when it happened, but I had the urge to remember or to record the little that I remember. So I didn't want to forget everything. I felt that I had forgotten too much and that there's a danger in forgetting everything. And so by writing and starting to record and write the little that I remembered, I felt that I was fleshing out the ghosts. So I was dealing with the haunting.
Yeah. The body of evidence is in fact divided in five parts and has a little unusual structure combining essay, fiction, theory. In fact, the biggest newspaper in Finland, Helsingin Sanomat, claimed that with this work, you brought auto-theoretical literature to the Finnish literary scene. So could you elaborate a little bit, because you also use this term auto-theoretical narration and auto-theoretical literature. So what does that mean, and how is it different from auto-fiction?
I'm not sure if I can define definitely what autofiction means. I think it means different things for every writer and every reader. For me, it means implicit social critique, which I don't think autofiction can reach with such clarity. It's also a counter history, a counter document, which means that there is something. There's a sort of resistance happening in the writing. And I actually didn't choose a genre. It wasn't a conscious decision to write auto theory.
Yeah.
Or it wasn't even a conscious decision to write a memoir, because I feel it's also a memoir. I was rather chasing my memory and like running after the text. So the writing chose the genre. But I also think that sexual violence is made into fiction. So for me, it would have been dangerous to write fiction because it's already made into fiction. So I took the risk of becoming a speaking female subject who wants to declare the truth. And that's a dangerous position when you're declaring that you want to write the truth. So it gets me into a little bit of trouble, but I think that it also it would have been easier to ignore the book or undermine the book and the story if it was autofiction.
Exactly. Yeah. You give extreme importance to metaphors in your book. Metaphors are carriers of unspeakable. At the same time, it doesn't mean that by metaphors you're only telling something that would be easier to tell by metaphors and not to say something directly. So where lies the power of metaphor to you? Why do you rely on metaphor so much?
I think metaphor is a container, but it's a container that comes from lived experience. So I don't believe in trying to invent metaphors, like, okay, I want to write some metaphors here, let's go. It's rather that that there's something compelling that you need to emphasize. Or in my case, when you're living in a body that is repeating itself, it's quite natural or innate to have something that starts to reappear. And then when it appears again and again, you begin to see that it has other meanings. So I have the body and the room are actually, they're literal, but they're also metaphoric, so that they change places, they are interchangeable. So my body contains the rooms that I write about. My body is a place, it is a room. And then the rooms, I see them as places where memories of bodies hang or that are being haunted by the ghosts. So sometimes when I write room, it can mean the body, and sometimes when I write the body, it can mean the room. And actually the book is packed with metaphors, and murder is one of them. And I actually wouldn't like to use murder as a metaphor for sexual violence, because there are women and girls who are actually murdered, but it's something that Elaine Sixou refers to as the need to feel the pain as our own. So I wanted the reader to really understand the gravity and to understand the destruction and to understand how differently we take murder or death and how sexual violence kind of falls out of the radar because it's not so detrimental in a way or it's not the end of life, although it can feel like the end of life. And I also use the metaphor of war and I exhaust it. And by that I mean that you begin to see perhaps war differently or I begin to own the concept of war for my experience. So something happens to the metaphor as well.
Yeah. And this is where I'm just thinking now that even though you, as you say, the book is packed with metaphors and you use so many of them at the same time, you're so precise about the words and about the weight of words and what they mean. It really stuck with me the word in one interview. You said it's a memoir in the sense that it's a book of remembering, not in the sense as we maybe sometimes understand a memoir as a biography or autobiography, but it's precisely a book where one remembers. And this is, I'm just, this is something that you are talking now and comes to my mind, that the weight of words and how we understand words and how we take them into consideration come into light in the book very, very nicely. In the case of your book, I thought a lot about the role of art, the role of literature in remembering, in the process of remembering. Do you think that art in general can help in the process of reconstruction? And more specifically, what is the place of writing itself in this process? For instance, can we and should we maybe start writing before we even remember anything?
I think art is a method of archiving or anarchiving or counter-archiving. So, of course, it can become a site of remembering. So I remembered with other literatures and I remembered with music and I filled the gaps and the emptiness with other art and artists. So because my memory was so incomplete and I do feel that also makes memory something collective and shared, that it's not a private matter. And again, it kind of emphasizes the word of memory and makes memoir also something that is collective and shared. I think writing is memory and memory is writing. So when I was writing my memory, I was also shaping it and I was changing my history. I was molding it to look certain way for myself, which changes me and changes the past, and I think it can change the reader as well. But then there's also something unruly and untamed about memory, so that writing cannot and text cannot contain it, so we cannot control it fully. So we will remember outside of writing, and
What were the scariest moments for you when you started writing? What were you, were you scared about anything? And what, if you were, what were you scared of in the process of writing?
I think I was scared of exposure and shame. I thought I couldn't perhaps handle the shame, that it would be too much. And there's danger in the book. I write about the figure of sexual violence, which is like a static representation. And I was scared that I would become that, that I'm trying to get out of that by writing, but I will remake that figure. Because then when I am being interviewed in the media, for example, I am first and foremost a victim of sexual violence. That's what the media is interested in. And I'm secondly a writer. So I kind of recreate that. And then I have to, but I see that as a possibility. So I have to try to find ways in language to refuse that staticness and immobility. And so I feel it's also an opportunity to try to change the public discourse.
Yeah. And again, coming back to the auto-theoretical literature, and that's what perhaps one of the main goals of auto-theoretical literature. You have recently published a really beautiful column in the Finnish media called "Writing Belongs to Everyone." In it, you talk about writing as a tool for exploring, exactly as we're discussing it now, and giving names to things or concepts, and a tool for making change. You claim that writing indeed belongs to everyone and is valuable in itself, no matter whether the text actually get published or not. You yourself say that you wrote your own book first and foremost to and for yourself. So here is where I want to pose a little provocative question. If we write to ourselves, if we claim that we write a book or books to ourselves, why publish such books then? And how do we decide which books deserve to be published, especially in the case of auto-fictional literature?
I wrote that column because I wanted to separate between writing and publishing. I think there are two different things. And I need to write for myself, first of all, because if I would write for the audience, I would be writing for the critic. I would be writing from fear. I couldn't get to the truth. I couldn't write honestly. I would want to make myself look prettier in the text than what I am. So, and I think it's something for writers to think about. And Ocean Vuong has said something about questioning yourself and staying with the text so long that even yourself disappears. So then you're just, he says it very beautifully, you're just a series of consciousness. So I think even the self has to leave, the ego has to leave, the audience has to leave, everyone has to leave the room until you're in some kind of weird state of approaching knowledge that is not limited by even your own small self. And I don't think it's possible to write that way unless you're writing for yourself, unless you are abandoning the idea of publication. And I didn't know if my book would be published. I didn't think about that. I didn't know anything about publishing industry, so yeah. I wasn't very optimistic even. And even at the very end of the process, I was still wondering if this should be published or not. And I think there's something interesting in that idea of because of the loudness and the publicity and everything, the kind of competition that we have in the public space about whose voice can be heard. It kind of excites me, the idea of that I'm writing something, but I don't know if it will be published. It feeds me, feeds my creative energy in some way.
Yeah. When author Antti Rönkä was here on our podcast discussing shame, he said an interesting notion. He said that Finnish literature has often denied emotions. Would you agree?
I don't know if all emotions, maybe shame. I think Antti Rönkä is writing about shame. So I would agree on that. And it's simply because shame doesn't want to be spoken of. It doesn't want to be written. So it's very difficult. But it relates back to the idea of exposure, what I was afraid of. And I think in Finland we're extra afraid of exposure. And we have a culture that rather silences us and is scared about oversharing things. So when we confuse that with literature, I think there is authors have to negotiate a risk of being exposed. And this relates to confession. And again, I have to cite Ellen Siksu. I read her a lot these days. She explains confession as an erasure. So it's like you're confessing your sins to an audience, but it's not, you're not supposed to confess publicly to an audience. So that creates friction and that creates a conflict. And that also creates forgetfulness, because confession is something that you can just set aside. Okay, so that was horrible. I almost didn't want to hear about that, and now I will forget about that. Yeah. And I really thought about this when I was writing, that I want this to go under the skin of the reader so that the reader cannot ignore it and cannot forget about it. So then it's rethinking the idea of confession. But I think in Finnish literature, we are a little bit afraid, and we have this culture that something that is intimate, something that is corporeal, something that is sexual, something that is violent, and to speak about that and to write about that is to confess.
Yeah, yeah. In one of the interviews, you were asked whether writing helps or has helped you with the healing process, to which you answered that you don't exactly believe even in the concept of healing. But then again, you said many times that a victim of abuse feels guilt as long as they are not able to show or to prove that they are not guilty, and that writing this book for you personally was the way of proving that to yourself. So I want to ask about this notion or notions of healing and redemption, and it also relates to confession in some way. How do you understand healing and redemption? Do you believe in them at all? And if so, can they be reached through the making of art?
I write in the book that I was destroyed and that I was born into the body of a 12-year-old. So with that kind of violence, healing just doesn't feel very appealing to me. It feels like it diminishes the wound. Yeah. That somehow the wound needs to stay open for me. It's a refusal to close it, because that closing would lead to forgetting and getting over. And I'm interested in the possibilities that lie in that wound, what is festering in there. And also all the kind of negative energy that is festering in there. And because I've already used that to write a book, so it feels odd to let go of that kind of energy. But then there are also certain things that won't heal. Like I have memory problems. I have dissociated a lot in my life. So, for example, I feel that I don't have a sense of linear memory that causes some problems for me. So that cannot heal. So then the question is, what can I do about it, and what possibilities lie in there? Maybe it's that I can write differently. I can think differently. But then at the same time, the book is a place of justice. So I kind of awaken this character of a detective who goes into this cold Kemijoki River and dives deep. Yeah. And in the water, like, she can only find decomposed bodies and ghosts. And then she creates this archive of evidence, but it doesn't apply in a court of justice. It doesn't mean anything there. So in the end, I'm alone in the court, and I'm only trying to convince myself. But I think that is more important that I do this for myself, and I prove my own innocence to myself, and I go through my history and the archival process. In order to recover my dignity. So that takes priority over healing. And I have this sense that healing is for someone else. It's for the society. It's to make me a certain kind of person, perhaps less angry and more compliant. So that's why I want to challenge the concept of healing altogether.
If we set aside the concept of healing and redemption in some way, do the wounds transform somehow through this process of writing, of art, of remembering or trying to remember? Do the wounds themselves can transform?
I think they do. I think they remain, but they keep changing all the time. They keep reformating. And I think that's interesting because then you can create something from that. And I think that's a hopeful thought. thoughts that you can kind of access that. And it's like in summertime when you have scars and they become, at least on a white skin, they become visible, and then they kind of disappear in wintertime. It's already like something is changing on your skin. So the scars in your skin keep changing according to the rhythms of the sun.
Yeah. To finish, three very literary questions. Who is your current literary crush?
I would say Ocean Wong, because I keep listening to his interviews all the time. They calm me, and I think he's just so wise and compassionate, and I'm also, when I'm listening to him, I feel the urge to write, and I get really concrete ideas for writing, which is a great gift. So I keep listening to his talking. I also look forward to his next book. I think he's writing a novel.
Yeah. What was the most surprising book you've recently read?
It's a book that I'm still reading. It's by Elisa Washuta, White Magic. It's also a memoir. I read a lot of memoirs, but it's very uncanny, and it's very it's structured in a bizarre way, and it's also big. it's like it has a lot of pages. Yeah.
Which author or book never fails to make you laugh?
I tend to read books that are not very funny. And my humor is very dark. There's a Finnish author, Raisa Omaheimo. We got to know each other when we were publishing at the same time. And she has the same kind of dark, extreme humor that you cannot always share with other people. So she makes me laugh.
Thank you, Susanna Host.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was Literature from Finland, brought to you by Helsinki Literary Agency and hosted by me, Urte. Special thanks to Petri Latvala for the design and Alessandra Dana for the music, and to all the colleagues at the agency. Don't forget to tune in the next episode.